Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast, heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the May episode of AZMcast. So last month, we talked about the foundations of the neonatal fever evaluation, how well-appearing kids with fevers would quickly turn to death's door from a serious bacterial infection, how several studies determine the rule-out sepsis workup to identify low-risk kids, and how vaccines and a changing epidemiology turned all that on its head. Something I try to pound into our residents is that you can't apply a paper to a population that wasn't included in that study. And for years, we've been applying 1990s data to millennial babies. But if there's anything millennials seem to enjoy, it's 90s retro. So now it's time to talk about the updated rule-out sepsis study with P. Karn's new neonatal fever clinical decision instrument. Chan Lo and I break down this really well-done paper and discuss the implications and possibilities that it presents. The data are good, the science is solid, but are you going to use it in your practice? And if not, what would it take to get you there? Very interesting philosophic discussion on the applying evidence-based medicine. But for now, grab your slap bracelets and your hypercolor as we reboot 1990s medicine in this month's episode of AZMcast on neonatal fever. So there's been this lull, as we discussed, and then P. Karn yet again comes through with a very robust, very large population, very well-designed and done trial of a clinical prediction rule to identify febrile infants 60 days and younger at low risk for serious bacterial illnesses. Because reasonably, it has been a very long time since we've had any new kind of clinical decision aids or instruments to help us to figure out who's high risk and low risk, along with a new epidemiology. We've got a new group of febrile babies out there that don't have what the old febrile babies had. So along with your hypercolor shirts and your DVDs of Friends, your VHS tapes, and everything else that you had, what's old is now new again, and everything retro is back. So clinical prediction rules for babies is back. And this one is, I have to say, it is really good. Now, full disclosure, I'm doing the validation study with P. Karn right now, so of course I'm a little bit biased, but I don't know the results of those at all. Instead, we're looking at the one that they completed in April of 2018. And finding, looking at these studies, they derived and then validated a rule in the same population, which is a great study. They had a group of babies that were pretty comparable and that were representative of the population in a multi-center trial across the country, and they did a really good job. So they took, in the first sample, 900 infants and validated it with another 900 infants. So already in this one study, you've got more kids than in Rochester, Boston, and Philadelphia put together. So that's a huge number, and it happened within the last 10 years, which is a huge deal.
Yeah, and I think the nice thing about trying to do studies in this population is babies come in with fevers. And so we actually can get you know, through networks like PCARN or through the PRIZE network that's doing a similar study right now. PRIZE is pediatric research in the inpatient setting. We can get very high numbers when we start doing these multi-center trials. So this number, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who would argue that 900 is not a valid sample size.
Right. So when they evaluated this, they came up with kind of an SBI rule, and the first thing, knowing that that UTIs are the most common, is that a urinalysis has to be negative. And they defined a negative urinalysis by no leukocyte esterase, by no nitrites, and less than 5 white blood cells per high power field. So that is a truly negative urinalysis. The next was an absolute neutrophil count less than 4,090 microliters, cells per microliter. Why 4,090? Why not 4,000? Why not 4,100? It's because this is what the math showed was actually going to be predictive.
4,091.
No.
Equals death.
Yeah. Not necessarily. Let's hope. And then procalcitonin. This is the part that just makes me smile. Someone finally found a good use for procalcitonin. It was a test looking for a disease for a long time, and man, did they find a use for it. If the procalcitonin was less than 1.17 nanograms per ml, if you put all these together and this febrile baby has none of those, then the prediction rule showed a sensitivity of 98.8% in the derivation arm, 97.7% in the validation arm, and a negative predictive value of 99.8% and 99.6% respectively. That is huge.
Yeah, it's hard to find any other study that had that kind of a sensitivity and negative predictive rule. And now the specificity was not great, but you know, in a prediction rule that you're looking to really screen and rule out your negatives, specificity is a little less important. You want that high sensitivity to make sure you're not missing kids that you should catch.
Yeah, and so the important thing I always tell people is just because they had a procalcitonin that was 1.72 does not mean they're going to die.
Right.
It means you can no longer use this study. Okay? But you can use your best clinical judgment. You can talk with the families. Use some shared decision making. Try to talk with whoever's on. Figure out a plan for this kid. It does not mean they're going to die, but it does mean that you can't use this rule. Okay. Now, it's important anytime you use one of these clinical decision aids that you understand the population it was studied in. So they included all kids less than 60 days who had a fever of 38.0, either measured rectally in the ED or by any means at home in the last 24 hours. Okay? Now, any means at all. We can talk real quick about fever and measuring the fever in kids, because there's a lot of times that I ask the parents, so how high was the temperature? Well, we didn't actually measure it. What about those kids, Chan?
Yeah, that's always the tricky predicament. And even actually to some degree, even if they did measure it, it partially depends on how they measured it when they were at home. Because there's a nice study looking at tactile versus actual measured fever. And what it showed was that parents are pretty good at saying, like touching their baby and saying, my baby does not have a fever. But we are absolutely horrible at touching our babies and saying, that baby has a fever. And so
specifically, a fever of 38.4. Yeah, no, I missed a spot. It's 38.4 now.
That's right. Yeah, it's and then you know, especially those rectal manual temperatures are just rough, you know, mostly for the parent. But so I think that and then correlated to that too is, you know, these non-invasive thermometers for over-the-counter home use have just become pervasive throughout the. You go into Walgreens and you see, or CVS or whichever unnamed provider you prefer because we're not biased. You can go. There's whole aisles of thermometers out there, and the reliability of those thermometers sort of follows the same scheme as the old old touch test. They're pretty good if they say that the temperature is normal. The further they get from normal, the less reliable they are. And to the point where you really, if you want to make sure that they're truly febrile, you need to do a rectal temperature.
Yeah. One of the best pieces of advice I got from my pediatrician when we had our first kid was, Aaron, do you have a thermometer? I said, yeah, I do. He goes, great. Throw it away for 2 months. Because sometimes you just don't want to know.
You just don't want to know.
So that was the inclusion criteria. It's also important to know who cannot be pigeonholed into this same rule. So they excluded some infants. So they excluded anyone who appeared clinically ill, because you're going to do everything for a kid that's clinically ill. Anyone that received antibiotics in the last 48 hours, because you don't know if that's going to pre-treat, under-treat, is that going to actually change your absolute neutrophil count? So they didn't want to include those kids. Anyone who is premature, that's less than or equal to 36 weeks gestation. If they had pre-existing medical conditions, which they didn't spell out, but you can imagine children like that have trisomy 21, children that have congenital heart disease, or any kid that had an indwelling device or an obvious soft tissue infection. Of note, they were not excluding kids with otitis media, because traditionally we've been taught that ear infections cannot be the source when you're this young. Now, not sure if that's actually true, especially in this day and age where we've eliminated a lot of stuff. But back when strep pneumo and Haemophilus were the two biggest causes of ear infections as well, how are you going to know to stop there?
Yeah, I think that's an important point, because you know, the traditional teaching, and I looked to find a study to back this up, and I could not find it. But you know, the traditional teaching that I was taught was, you know, somewhere around only maybe 2-3% of ear infections will actually cause a fever more than 100.4. And so the approach we've always sort of taken is, the higher the fever, the less likely from an otitis media. Now, that doesn't mean that the virus they have that gave them the otitis media isn't causing the fever if they have influenza or some other virus, but I think it is worth the approach of saying, that's kind of a higher fever, maybe I should look a little more and not just blame the ear infection.
So this is a really impressive study. Not having been involved with any part of this, I can say it unbiased, that this is a really impressive study. I've been trying this for a while, and it's very good. The kids that I thought, yeah, there's no way that kid's going to have a, well, I was right, according to the rule. The kids that I thought, nah, there's no way that's going to, according to the rule, I was wrong. Because as it turns out, clinicians are pretty good at being able to identify that patient is super sick. We are not as good as saying, nah, there's no chance that kid has a serious bacterial infection. Turns out we don't get that right as often as we'd hope.
Yeah, I think that's the key is, you know, we in our training are pretty good at being able to recognize a sick kid. And all of these criteria, Rochester, Philadelphia, Boston, and even this PCARN tool, if they're sick looking, they're out, they're high risk. And so we're pretty good at identifying the they look sick kids. We are not very good at picking up the kids who are not that sick looking.
So even the rule missed 3 kids. All right. So out of 1,825 kids, I think, they missed 3 kids. And what did they miss? They missed 1 kid that had Enterobacter cloacae bacteremia, not a super common one, and they even comment that they got it positive on one blood culture and no subsequent blood cultures, which calls into question contaminant, maybe not, but you know, somewhat concerning. And then the other one, the other two were UTIs. One was an E. coli UTI, one was a Pseudomonas UTI. And so you could almost say with these kids still need follow-up. It's not 100% that you're going to catch every single one of them. And that actually makes me feel better. You always question a study that says, yeah, we can catch 100% of these kids using this criteria. Well, are you sure you just didn't find the one outlier? Are you sure you didn't find that one person who is PERC positive or PERC negative but still has a pulmonary embolus? Are you sure you didn't find that one person that should have ruled in but didn't? And so the fact that they missed 3 is strangely a little reassuring for me that, yeah, you may not catch all of them, but they did catch enough of them to make a difference.
Yeah, and you know, these, as you said back in the beginning, you know, this is a tool to aid us. You know, we don't, I think, want to get to the point where this becomes cookbook medicine and we just simply do the tests, and if they're low risk, that's it. We stop thinking about them. We definitely still want to take a look, and you know, because the study you referenced, we're pretty good at picking up the sick kids and saying, you know what, this kid has something. If that, you know, as you guys call it, if your haggis is going off and saying there is something wrong with this kid, that's the kid that you probably got to take a look at and make sure that you're not missing something.
Big applause to Chan for not only using the word haggis, but showing that he listens to this podcast, and he's not even an emergency doctor. He is a pediatrician. So thank you, Chan, for your loyal listenership.
You never know when you're going to be in an airport and they're going to have the little light go off, and I'll basically be able to say, because I listen to AZMcast, I know what to do on this plane.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, that's way overstating. You're certainly getting a turkey for that one. All right, so where are we at now? So what's our approach? You know, I think first we have to determine, is this a real fever or not? And then, you know, there's the age cutoffs. We had a discussion already of, we've got this new rule. Great. Let's just blindly apply this to everybody. I don't know that we're ready to do that. I don't think people are comfortable enough to do that, because we talked about, okay, so we all kind of thought that the 29-day and older baby, you know, this 1 month, this 1 month old is probably going to be fine if they look fine. But how many, like, less than 28-day-olds were actually included in this study? Well, it turns out that it was 500. That's a lot. 525, I think it was. So that's a lot of kids included in this study. But then the next question is, well, but how many of them were 3-week-olds, and how many of them were 2-week-olds? And then the question after we figure that out is, well, how many of them were 9 days, and how many of them were 8 days? I mean, as much as we talked about, you shouldn't be afraid of these kids, we don't like fear-based learning, there is a degree of, I don't know, like, how specific can we be? Can I send a febrile 2-day-old home if this criteria is met? And yeah, you probably could, but are you going to feel comfortable with that? And so we haven't discussed exactly how we're even going to do this in our groups yet, but I think that what this helps you to figure out is which kids need to be antibiosed now, and which kids you might be able to watch on the inpatient side, which kids with really close outpatient follow-up can you send home without doing anything more than what this study calls for, which kids can avoid the LP. These are all discussions that are probably going to have sub-analyses from the PCARN study, but I think this approach is now a little bit narrowed in, and fortunately it shows we don't have to do as much as even some people were doing.
Yeah, I think, as you say, one of the things in the publication, you know, they break it down at less than 28 days old, 555. So odds are they had a pretty good spectrum of ages in there. I actually would have liked, this is not a criticism of the paper, but I would have liked for them to break that age down a little bit better. Because if I could look at this paper and say, wow, they had 100 kids who were in the age of, you know, 0 to 7 days old, that might make me feel a lot more comfortable about saying maybe this rule can be used, rather than if, you know, they had 500 kids, but 550 of the 555 were 21 to 28 days old.
Mm-hmm. So I think that the kids greater than 60 days, we really don't worry about as much until we actually find something that makes sense as a source, like a urine. I think a lot of these kids can go home if they've got a negative urine and they seem to have a virally source and everybody else in the home has a virus. These kids that are 28 to 60 days, we should probably be getting some blood, getting a blood culture, getting a urinalysis, and then if they meet this low-risk criteria, then it's a discussion, as it always is with children, of comfort from caregivers, access to medical care, health literacy of the parents or the caregivers, the guardians that are there, to determine, is this a kid that can go home or is this a kid that needs to be admitted for observation? And then the less than 28 days is kind of the new frontier. So it's really cool to see that in the last 30 years, we've come from 90 days to somewhere around 28 days and maybe even less than that. To give a little bit of a primer, primer, because P. Karn has released some of this literature already, is they are working on these biosignatures, which is going to be hopefully a replacement of cultures, a 100-year-old medical practice of taking a sample of whatever you have and culturing it. This is kind of the new wave of the future. It would be really impressive if these things work, because they can be run on a PCR platform and come back in 2 to 4 hours. Because it's not a small thing that we're doing when we admit these kids to the hospital. It's not just the annoyance of a hospital stay. It's exposure to everything in the hospital. It's lost days of work. It's the cost of a hospitalization. And probably more and more as we figure this out, it's messing with the kids' microbiome as we give them broad spectrum antibiotics for 2 days. So it's nice that even though we've had this lull for a while, that we're seeing some real impressive headway coming out. We're hopeful that P. Karn continues to put out some good stuff, that Prize continues to put out some good stuff, and that we can actually do more for less.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, being a hospitalist, you know, one of the things that's always in my mind is that, and you know, sad to say, the place that I work every day is not necessarily the safest place to be. And so, you know, as we admit these, everything we do in medicine really is risk benefit. And now the conversation has really begun to change. Before, there was no doubt the risk was way too high to send these kids home with, you know, Haemophilus meningitis and all these different, you know, bad infections out there. But now it's really the thought of, is it safer for me to let you go home rather than being admitted, where, you know, it's not a, I don't have horrible things happening every day, but babies, you know, the IVs infiltrate and they get skin burns from the, you know, antibiotic infiltrating into their arm, or, you know, they can get mishaps happen and they get the wrong medication. I mean, these aren't common things, but they most certainly happen. And so if we can mitigate those risks as well, that has to be included in the balance, so that now, you know, as we're starting to work out these things and these, you know, biomarkers and things too, we're seeing these decreases in bad things like meningitis, but we are seeing the increase of is a lot of these autoimmune diseases and things, and it may well be it's because we're whacking with the microbiomes.
Right. And so again, it comes down to, you know, your comfort of being able to send this patient home. The parent's comfort being able to send these patients home is aided by these clinical decision aids. Mm-hmm. You still have a caveat at all times to say, there's something not right about this. I'm going to go with my haggis and I'm going to do the full thing. I remember talking with Chan one time and he said, wow, why'd you tap this kid? I was like, oh man, like they seemed really sick when they got here. And the kid had enterovirus meningitis. He goes, good catch. And that's kind of all the reward you get for finding enterovirus meningitis. But I was happy to, okay, yeah, we caught something. You know, I just didn't feel right about this kid. I didn't like the way they looked. So more exposure to sick kids, more clinical experience is going to help. So as a resident, you try to see as many of these sick kids as possible. You know, we find ourselves arguing with parents sometimes about doing the full roulette sepsis, about why we need this invasive spinal tap, why we need these things. There was an interesting study about physicians versus parents' values for clinical outcomes for febrile babies. And basically what it showed is that physicians are worried about the long term of what if we miss something. Parents are worried about, I don't want my kid to feel pain right now. I don't want to be inconvenienced or to have to see my child go through this right now. And so it's a complete dichotomy. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat there at the bedside and all but lied through my teeth to tell the family why I was so worried about this, to get them to agree to the roulette sepsis workup, because it's quote unquote the right thing to do. I would always pull the example of a kid I had with leukocyte adhesion defect who grew 3 different organisms out of blood, urine, and CSF and say, see, we just don't know, you know? But I always felt guilty doing that, because deep down you often know, man, I think this is just a virus. But it's nice to have progressive
evidence that is quality evidence that we can put forth that can kind of allay some of our fears that we have with kids that can't give us a history, don't have a reliable physical, but have something that's off. My hope is that at some point we will be able to tell parents across the board, I'm not worried about your child's fever as long as they look okay and as long as they are appearing well and doing everything else. There's nothing to worry about from the height of the fever or anything else. It's all about how your child appears. I'm also looking forward to a day where residents have kind of forgotten how to do LPs. Nobody does them. The whole roulette sepsis workup is gone. Unlike now, where I just have residents that don't know how to do LPs. I'm just teasing. So it's a great place. It's nice to see a breakthrough in an area that's just been so many questions for so long.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree with that too. I think one other thing to keep in mind, you know, with these kids is, these decision rules are great, but the other things that you mentioned, Aaron, earlier, the plan of this, like, well, how far do they live? Do they live 4 hours away? And you know what? They don't have running water. Like those types of things play into these decisions, and so we often think about these kids as like, we're either going to tap them or we're going to admit and do antibiotics, or we're going to send them home. But there's a middle ground of we're going to just admit and watch and not do antibiotics and maybe not do the LP. But, you know, this family lives a little further away. I'm just not comfortable letting them go home. Maybe that's the kid that needs to spend the night in the hospital and we can watch them without doing antibiotics. And now instead of in the emergency room having to face the pressures of I got to make a decision about what I'm going to do with this kid, now we get the benefit as the hospitalist of saying I've watched this baby now for 24 hours and they're continuing to do well, I'm okay with letting them go home.
I talked to a colleague the other day about what we're going to do with this, and we were both posed the question, so are you going to let a six-day-old fever go home? And he goes, yeah, I'm not doing that. And you know what? I'm not doing that either right now. But hopefully, we'll be able to do this in the future when we actually have better tests and when we've had some time to experience this. I heard someone say that it usually takes from the time a study starts until it's adapted into the general population about 15 years for medical literature to actually work its way into clinical practice with a good degree of consistency. So hopefully with evidence-based medicine, with free open access medical education, like podcasts and blogs and everything, we can disseminate some of this information. And you can see that this is working. Hopefully it works for you the same. We can stop stabbing babies, which is always a good day. So Chan, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. And I look forward to not admitting as many patients to you in the future.
I look forward to not admitting them as well.
Hi, podcast world. Thank you so much, Aaron, for the opportunity to provide a response to your podcast on the febrile infant. My name is Anna McFarlane. I'm the program director of the Combined Pediatric Emergency Medicine Residency at LSU in New Orleans. I have a really unique opportunity to work at multiple different types of practice. I primarily work at Children's Hospital of New Orleans, which is a freestanding children's hospital. We see about 50,000 peds visits per year in the ED with full subspecialty availability. We're a tertiary care center with a big catchment area. Lots of patients are transferred to us from the surrounding parishes, so I get the opportunity to both see a ton of peds patients in a dedicated PDD, but also seeing what happens out in the community coming into us as we're taking those patients as transfers. And then I also have the opportunity to work in both a community and an academic general, and put this in air quotes, adult emergency departments. Neither of these departments admit children, and the providers there have a variable comfort level with pediatric patients. This gives me, again, a unique perspective at kind of seeing how things are done out there in the community versus how things are done in our PDD, and kind of being maybe a resource for some of our providers who really just don't really know what to do with these febrile infants when they come in. I'd like to give a giant kudos to Aaron for tackling this huge topic. You asked me to comment on how this relates to my typical ED day, and I would tell you that fever is one of the most common presenting complaints to the ED in the pediatric patient. And whether I'm in the PDD or a general ED, this discussion is really important and something that affects us on a regular basis It's incredibly relevant, and it was refreshing to hear such a common sense approach from y'all. One of the points I found most interesting was the skepticism with which the Rochester, Boston, and Philadelphia criteria were met initially. I've given lectures on the approach to the febrile infant, and I usually start at that point. So that's sort of where these studies, along with the 1993 ACEP clinical policy guidelines, provided the rule book. That was the recipe book, and that's what I learned, that those things were the gold standard. And it made the assessment of the febrile infant really pretty easy. Here's the rule book. You just follow that. And that was my jumping off place for the discussion about the series of all these smaller sort of piecemeal studies since then. And the idea that initially there was skepticism around the implementation of these landmark papers puts really the emergence of PCAR now, the leap that it would really take for me to discharge that two-week-old infant with fever home now, into an interesting perspective. The idea that that same sort of skepticism and hesitation was present when those studies first emerged. So it also really brings Aaron's comment about the adaptation of studies taking 15 years into perspective, and to think that 15 years from now, you know, hopefully we'll be talking about PCARN as the gold standard as we start talking about the next best thing. You talked a lot about applying these studies to the well-appearing infant. And, you know, for us, the comment was made that we all are pretty good at identifying the toxic baby. And I think that's true for those of us with training in pediatrics. So general pediatricians, those of us who have dual training in EM and peds, people who are fellowship trained, or even the emergency provider who sees a lot of pediatric patients in their practice, to reliably really say, yeah, I can identify that sick neonate, the toxic baby that all those studies exclude, like that they are reliably able to say, okay, this baby does not really fit into the population that study was looking at. But I work with enough providers who really don't see that many kids. The residents I hear from who graduate still really uncomfortable seeing babies, to really know that maybe all emergency medicine providers don't necessarily feel 100% comfortable really identifying this sick neonate. And sometimes these little babies, they're not super clear about presenting as sick. And maybe they do these subtle things. Maybe there's a subtle change in their breathing pattern, or whatever alerts you and I, whatever kind of alerts our spidey sense. Does the emergency provider who doesn't see a whole lot of kids, is their spidey sense as finely tuned? And I think that's an important point to consider when applying some of these protocols that are particularly aggressive in discharging patients, that it really, those studies are predicated on the fact that they're able to identify a neonate who looks sick. And I've seen enough patients who are transferred in, who are sold to us as being completely normal, completely stable, who might, when they show up, look sicker than what the community provider maybe thought. You know, I think that there's maybe a role in having these providers maybe stay a little bit more conservative, to say, hey, look, if you don't really 100% feel like you can identify that toxic baby, you maybe not don't have that good feel for that. Maybe there's something reassuring about falling back on that full septic workup, instead of really having those providers trying to push the envelope and discharge babies who are just, you know, 2-3 weeks old without that full workup. Lastly, prior to the new PCARN study being published, I've really been trying to apply the step-by-step criteria to my personal evaluation of febrile infants. Like the 2015 study published in the Infectious Disease Journal that y'all referenced, these studies were both based in Europe. They were some of the first studies to push that envelope down to 21 days, suggesting maybe no TAP and discharge in those low-risk babies 21 days or older. Y'all didn't talk a lot about the step-by-step article, so just as a quick review, you know, they initially looked at 1,100 kids, and the validation study nearly doubled that, with about 2,200 kids. They studied babies 90 days and less, looking at similar criteria. Babies who are non-toxic with a negative UA, normal procal, ANC, and they also included a CRP. Their particular cutoffs were a procal less than 0.5, a CRP less than 20, and an ANC less than 10,000. And in this population, they miss 0.7% of IBIs, or invasive bacterial infections, which they call bacteremia and meningitis, and 0.4% of non-IBIs, which they called UTIs and enteritis. And interestingly, if you look at their actual data and adjust the age to 28 days, they really only missed 0.3% of IBIs, which is pretty similar to that PCARN group. All of the PCARN misses were also in babies over 30 days. So when you take it a step further, of those babies they missed, each of them really only had a fever for a really short time. For example, like they had their first fever in the ER. And this can be a reminder as to the limitations of procalcitonin and CRP, that they take a little bit of time to rise. And so step-by-step performs pretty darn well, and it's probably performed as good as anything up until PCARN. And it sort of really only includes those older babies in the low risk. So it's a good study to look at as well. It's sort of similar to PCARN that also reminds us as to the limitations of procalcitonin. So I'm really excited to be teaching step-by-step and to be applying that to our patients. I'm excited about the possibilities of PCARN going forward, but I'm still pretty cautious about sending that 8-day-old home with fever. That's still a leap of faith that I'm probably going to get there, and I think many of us will, as we see additional data with the validation study that will hopefully fully support the initial study. And hopefully that validation study will also give us a further sub-analysis, maybe even by week, to really say, okay, 2 weeks and above who meet these low-risk criteria can go home, but less than that, maybe not. I don't know. I don't know where that line is going to be drawn, but I'd like to see a little more sub-analysis before I'm ready to fully implement it. In the meantime, I'm probably still going to err towards the side of a full workup for those kids less than 28 days. Like you guys said, you're really excited and support PCARN, but it's a little much right now just to go out and fully implement it, at least for me. I may start inching that down to 21 days, both in line with sort of what PCARN's saying, but with also with the ID journal and with step-by-step, if I'm feeling bold, and probably most importantly, if I have a family that's in favor of that, and really I can sit down and have that discussion about shared decision-making. I love the idea going forward of being able to stop the fever phobia, stop the madness, and really assess a kid in the future by how they look rather than just plus or minus a fever, and especially applying this to a low-risk infant when the parent doesn't want the tap. I also feel uncomfortable sometimes feeling like we're really at odds with parents, and this is kind of one step further to really saying, hey, look, maybe we don't need this. Maybe I don't need to force a parent to have their baby undergo this sort of workup. So from here, the next conversation I really want to have is with our hospitalist, and to say, hey, look, maybe we're not ready to send these babies home yet, but maybe that 2-week-old who meets full, you know, meets low-risk criteria, maybe they could be hospitalized without an LP, without antibiotics, and just with OBS. And maybe that's the first step into sort of applying these before the validation study comes out. I guess we'll see how this all unfolds. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate. I've loved going back and listening to old episodes. Keep up the good work, and thanks again, guys.